space station, and that was sent up by Japan. And in that module, they have an airlock system. You know, you can take small satellites that different colleges build. For instance, they build these CubeSats. We've had some HamSats that have been built. They get sent up now by either Cygnus or the H2 cargo vehicle. Or even the Dragon, and they'll bring them inside this space station. They'll check them out, put them on this, you know, open this door for this airlock, this small airlock that they have. You can maybe launch something, like a small refrigerator or something, you know. You can put it inside, and, you know, you open up the outer airlock, and then this thing gets pushed outside, and grab the whole, you know, they grab a hold of it by a Japanese robotic arm, and they deploy it, and they do this about 10 times a year. That's how many times this thing can function, about 10 times a year. Let me drop it. And out of the 10 times, about 5 of them are dedicated to Japan, naturally. It's their whole setup. When this all went up, you know, they were designing these things in the late 1990s and the early 2000s. They didn't know that these CubeSats, different satellites that they're testing, would become so popular. There's private companies having these things built that are being sent up to the space station. There's a lot of competition because, like I said, they can only launch about 10 of these things per year, or they can open a door. They, you know, you can put 10 satellites in at one time, but you can only open a door roughly about 10 times per year. And the private companies that are doing this are going to get together, and they're going to pay to send another unit up, another airlock system that could basically do the same thing, except bigger. You know, this thing's maybe the size of a full refrigerator. You know, it's going to be a bigger one, and they want to attach it to the Node 3. Node 3 is, well, the Tranquility module, and there'll be an open port left there. All these nodes, you know, have half a dozen ports, literally all over, and a lot of them get utilized. When they disconnect the, there's a docking fixture, a pressure mating adapter, they call it PMA-3. They're going to disconnect in the near future, probably within a year, and they're going to relocate it to a different node, and that's eventually going to be used for commercial crewed flights. They're going to enter through that. They have to relocate that. That's going to leave an open port on the Tranquility module. These private companies are going to pay millions of dollars to get this thing up there and attach it to that node, that door, and eventually we'll have our own. Let me drop it. By private companies in the United States, that they'll be able to open the door, that they're going to design it for like 20 times a year, that they'll be able to open this thing and close it, put that into operation. And the thing they like about it, NASA will actually pay back money to, or make some kind of a deal with this company that installs this thing, to bring in, let's say, equipment. There's equipment that's stored on the International Space Station. That the last few shuttle flights went up, and they stored thousands of tons of these different pieces, that pumps and all kinds of equipment that is attached to the outside of the space station, just sitting there waiting for some component to fail, and which they have in the past. There's been ammonia pumps that have failed, and they'll do an EVA, and they'll take one of these spares, and they'll replace it. Eventually, they're going to run out of spares, and we don't have anything big enough. We don't have a space shuttle to bring up a whole lot of new things at one time. You know, you'd have to have a Dragon spacecraft come up with one piece at a time. So rather than do that, let's say, for instance, they had this big, it was like a big suitcase type of voltage regulator setup that they just replaced on the far end, on the starboard solar panel that had failed. they could do is they could actually bring this thing in through this big airlock that they're eventually going to have. Bring it inside. You can get guys like Scott Kelly and some of the astronauts that are in, on board, and they could do surgery, open it up and pull out, you know, the little board that might be defective. NASA could tell them which one it is. Here's a new one. You know, you could send it up in any one of the cargo vehicles, pull that out, push it, big thing, and it could be a tank. They, you know, we have big tanks that are sitting on the outside of the space station there with valves and things on it. They might need to change something like that. You'd be able to theoretically do that on board the space station, and that would save a lot of problems with eventually resupplying the space station with equipment that eventually fails. The stuff isn't forever. That's all I wanted to bring up, Dick. K2RAW, WS2N. Okay. I hope all that got through, John. KC2WGB, WS2N. This is Paul for the space portion of the TechNet.
Okay, Paul, very good. Dick probably had to make a run somewhere, but if you have another subject, I guess you might as well start that.
Yeah, I'm back, and sorry about that. I called away for a minute. The you do have another subject, Paul, or do you recommend we go over to back to the mailbag? Your choice, Paul. WS2N, K2RAW.
No, that's it for now, unless somebody has any questions, but I would like to see this thing get built. And the interesting thing is, you know, you talk about, I just want to say one other thing, Dick. Earlier in the net, you talk about certain things that you don't read anywhere, you know, even on the internet, about some of the things that you come up and talk about. We talk about, you know, residents of the antenna or whatever. I noticed if I've looked for the configuration of the International Space Station, exact layout, it is almost impossible to find it on the internet. In fact, I can't find the exact layout in any kind of picture form. I did find one in a diagram form, like an exploded view. It's pretty amazing. So some of the things that we cover on the net, you know, I'm not saying it's impossible to find it out in the outside world, but we do find some things here. You know, I could give you an exact layout of the International Space Station. There's no models to be had. There's no companies that put out a model that, you know, you could give a kid for Christmas or holidays, birthday, and say, hey, this is the International Space Station. It's kind of weird, but that's the way it is. Back to you, Dick. I just want to bring that up.
It is sad that Mattel hasn't created a model, but if you think about it, the model would have a whole lot of things sticking out in all kinds of places. Yep. Solar panels, the heat radiators, and so on. So to make a model that is even close to scale, and yet make it strong enough that when a child drops it, it doesn't break off pieces, that would be difficult. Quite elaborate. Can you imagine the degree of difficulty of making a Mattel model of the International Space Station? Back to you on that one, Paul.
I realize that, you know, in today's world, I thought they could do it. All right, you don't have to have all the different modules, you know, bolting up with their 16 bolts, but, you know, have them, you know, close enough where they could maybe a half turn would put them together, and then you could disconnect them and put them in a different configuration. You know, they were originally set up a certain way, and they have made changes. Like, they took the PMM, the permanent multi-purpose module that we used to, a big freaking module. They're attached on the bottom of one of the nodes, on node one. Eventually, they relocated to the forward-facing location on node three. And they could give it a half twist and unscrew it and put it on node three, you know. And I would imagine, you know, somebody can come up with something like that. They, you know, what was it? Hot Wheels used to have the different spacecraft years ago. you know, the, what was the Pathfinder, when they went to Mars, a small rover that looked like a microwave. They made up one, and, you know, you could buy it. I bought one, and it was great. You know, you really a good replica. But then they stopped doing it. There was no Curiosity. There was no, naturally, there's no space station. They had shuttles, and they had Apollo 5 rockets, the whole assembly with the Apollo and the Saturn V set up. They had all that years ago. No more. Back in there.
One other thing that I want to review with you, Paul. I think you told me that the International Space Station runs at an air pressure of 14.7 pounds per square inch, just like on surface of Earth. And I think the International, I think the space shuttle also ran at 14.7. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
Yes, but they would lower it down to 10 psi if they were going to do a spacewalk. And even so, they had an airlock system on that. But yeah, the normal operation was 14.7. And the same for the Mir spacecraft, too. Mir space station. They eventually had the same pressure. Now, in the beginning, they would change the pressure on the International Space Station back to 10.5 if they were doing a docking with the shuttle, you know, doing some kind of operation, because they didn't have a, you know, when it was first, they had a couple of modules, they didn't have an airlock. Eventually we wound up with the Quest airlock, and the Russians wound up with the Pyrrhus airlock, and you know, things got better. So now the whole space station stays 14.7, but you go into the airlock, and that changes. They leave them in there usually for a day before the flight at a lower pressure, I think 10 point something pounds, and then that helps the bend, so they don't get the bend.
Okay, so they lower from 14.7 down to something like 10.5. Is that done because you're now docking with the space shuttle in the old days, or is it because an astronaut is preparing for the next step of doing an EVA? And what pressure does a suit run at during an EVA? How about you, Paul? K2LIW?
EVAs are all 5 pounds. They've lowered it a little bit. You know, you get closer to 3 pounds, 3.5 or something. Some cases, they managed to go down a little bit, but I mean they were a solid 5 years ago, and probably are, you know, to some degree now. Maybe with the Russians, maybe they'll mention that when they do the EVA on Wednesday with the all-in space spacesuits, a different setup than we have. We've had Americans go into the Russian spacesuit and vice versa in the past. It turned out to be good. Now, this is a tough week for NASA, by the way, because all the dates for real problems where astronauts have gotten killed during this month. January 27th was the Apollo fire. And that's what I'm thinking about now with the oxygen problems that they had, the overpressurization of oxygen in there, and then of course after that was the 28th on the January 28th for Challenger, and then actually February 1st tomorrow would be STS-107 Columbia that disintegrated coming back. So you know, a total of 17 astronauts we've lost in this time frame. So I think it's a tough time for NASA right now. They've had a lot of memorials down there. But we keep on going here on the net. Talk about the future. Back to you, Dick.
Did the space shuttle run at 14.7 even during a docking procedure, Paul? Go ahead.
I think they went down to 10.5, as I recall, before any kind of docking. But with the the anything with either Mir or the space station. They would lower it, and then after docking, that would change. And then they would bring everything back up to 14.7 for both vehicles. Mission would unload a lot of stuff, tons of stuff inside the cabin. That, you know, they go back and forth all day long. A lot of the equipment, the big stuff, the big science racks and everything would be unloaded using the, like for instance, the Leonardo multi-purpose module that was in the back of the space shuttle. It was big. It was, you know, 28 feet long and 14 feet in diameter. The robotic arm would grab it, attach it to one of the nodes, open it up, and they'd go in and out of that, you know, for the next 4 or 5 or 10 days, however long they were attached to the space station. Sometimes longer. Back to you, Dick. You're wondering about the pressure, though, I can see. What are we getting at here?
Yeah, I'm a little bit confused. Shuttle runs at 14.7. International Space Station runs at 14.7. Both get lowered to 10.5 during a docking procedure. I'm quite sure why that has to be. And I know that pretty soon there's going to be an inflatable module going to be brought up. And what pressure is that going to be running at? Back to you, Paul. How soon is that inflatable module going up? K2LAW.
That was only in the early days that they would lower the space station. Space station stays at 14.7 now all the time, except for the Quest Lab. That's where it's different. The Quest Lab is designed for EVAs. And that's another module attached to Node 1, Unity, starboard side. And that's different. You know, you go in there, you close the door behind you, and you could change that pressure to 10.7 and leave two astronauts in there for, like, well, not all day, but, you know, they'd sleep there overnight, and then it would change the oxygen in the blood, and they could even come back and join the rest of the crew for breakfast. For some reason, it doesn't change that fast, and then they have less of a time actually depressurizing and getting used to the 5 pounds of oxygen that's in their spacesuit. But the way it's set up now, you're going to have crewed vehicles. You're going to have the Dragon crewed vehicle or the Boeing Starliner come up and dock. It's different. They'll be able to leave everything at 14.7. No problem. I'm going back in the early days. That's the only time they would lower the pressure on the inside of the space station. They don't do that anymore. No need to. You have the airlocks.
Yeah, air pressure is something you got to worry about. We take it for granted, but when you've got a large volume object like these modules, the total pressure that's built up on those walls turns out to some really big numbers. There was a news report tonight, slightly different subject, of a person who drove into a puddle in the last day or two, and the car went under. It was a station wagon-like vehicle that went underwater, and the front of it sunk in this very deep puddle, and the water was rising, and the person was eventually in the back of the vehicle with what little air was left with the children, and the water had shorted out the system, or the electrical system, so that they weren't able to operate the windows or the automatic door locks. So all the doors were locked, all the windows were up, and until a fireman came along with an axe and hacked through the rear window of the station wagon. They just barely did that in time to stop the occupants inside from drowning. And the news report basically said, make sure you don't drive into deep puddles, particularly at nighttime where you can't see the depth. The news reports, as I see it, are lacking one very important piece of information. Let me drop it. And that is, we all should have burned into our mind that whenever your vehicle is about to go into water, make sure the windows are open. Because when there's water outside your vehicle pressing on that door, the water pressure on the outside is so large, you cannot open the door. If you're going to leave that vehicle, you're going to leave by swimming out a window. Make sure the window is open whenever your vehicle goes near or is about to be engulfed in water. And the news reports don't mention that. And that's a sad situation because a number of people on Long Island every year die in their automobile because it goes into water and they're not able to leave the automobile. I wonder if you've heard news along these lines, Paul. WS2N, K2LAW.
A couple of years ago, MythBusters was on every week. They had a good show, and they did a show on getting trapped in a vehicle going on the water. And the battery and the electrical system was still operating. They were able to actually hit the switch, and they had enough time, still functional, to open up the window if they wanted to. But to open up the doors, they showed it. That was impossible force on the water. It was over. You had to go out through the window and try to break the window if you can, if you're on the inside. You asked about the beam. The beam is the inflatable module that's going to be put on the tranquility mode node, the aft bay, the door that they have on the tranquility. So the beam stands for Bigelow Expandable Activity Module. That's going to have 14.7 pounds on it as well, and that'll be going up probably in 3-4 months. SpaceX will be bringing it up. SpaceX has got a flight in February, end of February, I think, is the next flight. That's the SES-9. That's a geosynchronous flight. And then followed by either Beam, probably Beam will probably be next. And then one after that would be another cargo flight to the space station. The cars going in the water. Oh, a lot of people, you go off the dock, you got your window up. As you're flying through the air, last thing you think of...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Uh-oh, timed out.
Yeah, many people, their first impulse is to roll up the windows to keep the water out. And it's opposite of what you should be doing for survival. If your vehicle is about to enter water, make sure the windows are open. And unless you've got the right kind of a center punch tool, breaking a window from the inside is almost impossible. Arnold Schwarzenegger probably would not be able to kick out the window. Over to you, Paul, KQLAW.
Oh, no, there's no way. They had some kind of gadget or something. They kept in a glove compartment. Get what that was. Where you could actually break a window with it. I don't know what that was. If you ever saw that show, that was pretty good. No, I don't really have anything else. So if you want to go to somebody else, you can. I can tell you that Voyager 1 is almost, I think within a couple of days, it should be 134 AU away from, just about to cross that number. That's amazing, considering what Pluto's 39, this is 134. Back to you, Dick.
That's down the road a piece. And I think it's moving something like 35,000 or 40,000 miles an hour. Is that approximately the number, Paul?
I have a question for Paul.
They ask me mileage, but I always have it in kilometers. They'd have to do the math. I think it's 20 billion kilometers, and the other one's 16 billion kilometers. So. Gotta do the conversion. But it's out there. I like AUs. That gives me a better idea. I could say how many times the distance of Pluto is it. That's easy to wrap my head around. it's roughly 40, you know, you know how many times, say 134, you can say, so, you know, before you know it's going to be four times the distance of Pluto. Back to you, then.
Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Paul, I'm having an issue with those airlocks that you're talking about. Now, space station's at 14.7. They go into this room, which is the pre-EVA, and that's at 10.5. Okay, now I guess they go in there at normal pressure and then bleed out some at a very slow rate, and then after they acclimate, they get into a spacesuit, which goes to 5. But how do they acclimate for the spacesuit? Do they go in there and pressurize at 10.5 and then slowly bleed off the pressure? How do they do that without the bends coming on? Back to you, Paul. KC2WGB.
Yeah, that's why they have, they call it camping out. Medical, and, you know, I'm not going to be able to do it, but they need a lot of time. It's done by time. So if you put two guys in a room, the Quest Lab, you know, it's essentially two rooms. You have one way, you know, you put the two astronauts and you close the door, and then, you know, with their space that's already on, you know, you close the door, you depressurize it, you open the door, and out they go. The guy that helps them in the suits and out of the suits, in the last EVA that they did was Scott Kelly, was that astronaut. That's the room that they have to camp out in. In other words, they close the door behind them, they lower the pressure, more oxygen than normal. And the two guys that are in there and hanging out for almost a day and even sleeping there, their blood, you know, you get rid of a lot of the nitrogen in the blood. And even in the morning, they come out and join the other crew, you know, have breakfast, and then go back. Now they leave it at 14.7. But they're, you know, the job is already done. Their blood is already starting to get more oxygen in it, or less nitrogen. So now the time frame that they have in the spacesuit, when they bring the spacesuits down to 5 pounds, is a lot less than it used to be. That's the way I've read it, John. So back to you.
Yeah, but I think what John is asking is that you're bleeding off a certain amount of the nitrogen that has dissolved into your blood, and you go down to 10.5 or 10.7 as opposed to 14.7. Isn't there additional nitrogen to be bled off from your blood between a pressure of 10.7 and 5.0? Isn't there some more nitrogen that stays in even at that lower pressure, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, but if you're at 10.5 but you have an oxygen-rich atmosphere, not pure oxygen, you know, maybe more oxygen. I think that helps. That's the way I understand it. And I'd have a better handle on it if I scuba dive, and those guys would know. But I mean, you know, you watch them. You know, I mean, I've watched them many times on the. You know, they'll set up, they'll put the spacesuits on. You know, I mean, this is. You know, when they're ready to go, they'll put the spacesuits on, push the two guys into the other room. In this case, Scott Kelly closed the main door. It looks like a garage door, and they're in there, and I don't think they're in there more than 45 minutes inside their spaces. They depressurize that room, open up the outer hatch, and off they go. Back to you, just.
Yeah, what you've got to do is you've got to keep the partial pressure of oxygen the same. With normal 14.7, 20% of that is oxygen. And if you go down to 20% pressure, 5 pounds per square inch, so that's one-third. Let me think about that. 5 pounds per square inch, that's one-third of normal pressure. I think, therefore, you would go to 3 times normal oxygen, 60%. Is the spacesuit running at 60% oxygen at 5 pounds per square inch? Is that approximately the numbers, Paul? So that the oxygen partial pressure to get keep the body running, it's still the same. WS2N, KQLIW.
As far as I know, the oxygen was always 100% inside the spacesuits. So I don't think that's ever changed since day one when they started with that light. Now you can't run these rooms at 10.5 pure oxygen. That's how they got into trouble with the fire on Apollo 1 that killed Chaffee, White, and Grissom. They ran 14.7. They ran 20 pounds per square inch of pure oxygen inside that thing. And that's how they got in trouble. They wanted to duplicate being in space, you know. They wanted to duplicate 5 pounds of pressure inside of a spacecraft in orbit. it's already 14.7 here on Earth. They just went 5 pounds high. They ran it up to 20 pounds, and they realized you can't do that anymore. That kills people. Too easy to have a fire. Back to you.
Comment person, who are you? Go ahead, K2LAW. I'll give us your name and call.
How you doing, Dick? This is Mike number 2, K1MJM. Just a quick comment. Scuba diving, when they go down 30 feet is not a whole heck of a lot, really, for worrying about the bends. And that's 15 PSI, 14.7 PSI, one atmosphere. And if you're going from 5 PSI to 10 PSI or 15 PSI, you're only going about two-thirds of an atmosphere. I don't know if it's really that critical for that shallow a distance. That's all my comments. It's K1MJM. Back over to you.
Very fine, Mike. John, in the 10 minutes remaining, should we make an attempt at least starting on that mailbag question you had? KC2WGB, K2IW.
I think not, Dick. It's a little late for my guys, but no problem. We'll broach that next week. But I understand why the Apollo 1 craft did not have a blow-off hatch. They would have died anyway. If they blew that hatch at 20 PSI, their lungs would have burst.
That's right. That's what I read, John.
Wow. That's an extremely dangerous atmosphere they created. It's an extremely dangerous set of conditions. That combined with a socket wrench that was under one of the seats and shorting out two wires, I think that was believed to be what initiated the fire. Isn't that true, Paul?
And that was never confirmed. Never confirmed. But they, you know, I saw tests. They took aluminum, for instance, and put it in to the same pressure, 20 PSI with oxygen. And what happens with aluminum, even that will ignite the actual aluminum will start to shoot off sparks. I don't know what they were thinking, but they got away with it. You know, in other tests and other flights and things like that, they thought that they could do it, but, you know, one spark and it's all over. You'd think they would have done that, you know, that test in a lab somewhere, you know, lit a spark off intentionally, see what happens. And in those days, you know, they were just learning.
Had Mercury or Gemini been tested in a similar manner on the ground before the actual flight? Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, that's what I read, and they were getting away with this all this time, and they just thought this was normal, and that's what happened, you know. Naturally, your early Gemini flights, you know, they would pressurize the whole spacecraft before they would do an EVA. For instance, McDivitt and White were on a Gemini 4, and that was when he first did an EVA. Ed White went out. But, I mean, to do it, you didn't have an airlock, and they just made the whole spacecraft 5 pounds pure oxygen. Well, let's duplicate that on Earth. Okay, what do we got on Earth? 14.7, let's make it 20, you know, 20 psi and pure oxygen, and we'll kind of duplicate the pressures on the spacecraft that need to be duplicated. That didn't work out. They should have taken a whole spacecraft and put it inside a vacuum chamber and done that, and maybe they can, you know, just could have brought it up to 5 pounds psi. But this was, you know, an all plugged out test. This spacecraft was on top of a rocket on launch pad 37, and they just couldn't, you know, can't put the whole launch pad in a vacuum chamber.
There's something else bothering me here, Paul. And that is, if I put you in a room at 14.7 pounds per square inch with pure oxygen, 100% oxygen, after a period of time, your body is going to start behaving differently. And then if I go the next step of 20 pounds per square inch of pure oxygen, I think that makes physiological changes to a human being that are not desirable. I think you can start hallucinating. I think all kinds of funny things can happen. Over to you, Paul. KQLIW.
And they were in spacesuits. So that means the spacesuits had to be pressurized to the same thing. I don't know what they were thinking. I mean, it was supposed to be duplication of flight, but nowhere near it. And I don't know the medical results, what would happen if you were oxygenated. I don't know. I know about the 5 pounds on a spacesuit. That's about it. And what the space station runs at, and that's why they have nitrogen tanks up there and all. And, in fact, they just bought up more nitrogen tanks on the Cygnus spacecraft in that last flight. By the way, it's still attached. It went up in December, and it's not going to detach until probably the end of February. They were in there the other day taking more stuff out. It's loaded full of equipment and tools, clothes, supplies. Wow. Unbelievable. Back to you, Dick.
Dick, quick question.
Go ahead, John.
Too bad Dr. Roy isn't around. 100% pure oxygen, from what I understand, that damages the eye. I don't know what length of time, but I think that can cause blindness, if I'm not mistaken. I read that somewhere. Back to you.
In the case of a premature young child, absolutely, it can do eye damage. Whether or not it does that to an adult, I don't know. But I think there's some strong disadvantages of living on pure oxygen for any significant length of time. Maybe for just hours it's okay, but I think if you did that for a day, somehow I'm guessing there's going to be a side effect. Anybody have any further information on this? Give me a call. It is right now. K2LIW. Okay. What you guys heard was checking at number 1,587 and space report number 186. We'll be back next week. We'll discuss some of these repetitive subjects. Antennas, standing wave ratio, radar. To some degree, every subject is repetitive. To some degree. After 1,500 of them, you can't avoid it. But there's a little bit of a different slant each time. A little more to be gained, as I see it. Do you sometimes hear reports of people thinking that we're duplicating subjects, John? KC2WGB, KQIW.
Occasionally someone will make that comment, but they grouse about different things. But I'll explain to them that that has to be done because of new people who haven't heard the information. And like I have a couple of antenna questions here. That antenna questions were popular this week. And, you know, people will probably be bored next week. But I do have one question that's asked from a different point of view. And you've covered it many times. But he's asking a good question. And we'll get to that next week. You know, another thing about diving and air mixtures, there's a thing called nitrogen sarcosis, which divers experience. It's rapture of the deep, they call it. And that's with not properly mixed gases and too much downtime. The body reacts to those seemingly harmless elements in many different ways when you're in a different environment. It's really tough stuff.
Have you ever done any scuba diving, John?
Yes, quite a bit.
You've gone down to what depth, and you've been down how long?
35 was the wreck of the Rhone, which was 70 feet, and I never went any deeper than that, and I would never go that deep. That's a little too deep for my pleasure. I found that where I was doing the diving, like Bonaire and all of the Atlantic Islands, where the water was so clear, and you could see marvelous things at 10 meters. I mean, there was no reason to go any deeper than that. But, you know, you want to go down to shipwrecks and things like that, that's fine, but you really have to have the training. I enjoyed it, but I was a little spooked at the Rhone. You know, when you look at those crevices and things like that, it's just not something I was comfortable with. But I was only down there maybe 15 minutes.
I think you called it the wreck of the Rhone. Was there a ship called Rhone that you went down to at 70 feet? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, in the British West Indies. That was the wreck of the Rhone. The only other wreck I visited was at 900 feet, but I did that in a one of those Jack Christo submersible things with articulated arms, and that was a thrill. But I was completely safe inside the craft, two-man craft.
Assuming that all of the hardware on the craft kept working at 900 feet, I guess you had an emergency procedure by which you can drop the ballast if you wanted to come up in a hurry. Is that true?
It worked on hydrogen fuel cells, and it had these little propellers and a bunch of lights out there and these articulated arms, and there was a way to dump ballast, yes, but you didn't want to rise too quickly. It was like a big glass bubble. It was amazing. Sort of like a helicopter that you're in. The whole front was maybe 6 foot in diameter, but it was a big sphere of glass that you were looking through. Marvelous stuff.
At about 400 pounds PSI, John.
What was that, Paul?
Wouldn't that be about 400 pounds PSI? I think every foot is a half a pound, something like that.
I think you're right. You're close. I don't remember the exact pressure, but it was high. And there was, where we went, it was so, that was the Cayman Reef dive that it went down. And that Cayman Reef goes down 5,000 feet. 900 feet was enough for me. But it was really pretty. A lot of nice stuff down there.
What controls the buoyancy, John? If you sunk a little bit too far and lost buoyancy, other than dropping ballast, what's the fallback? Go ahead.
They do have emergency weights they can drop, but basically it's bladder control of air in tanks, that they will bleed out air, allow water to entrain, which will give you the buoyancy you need, or they can take the air and blast it in there and blow the water out. That's basically how they do it.
Have a tether at all?
What was that called?
Did you have a tether attached at all to this thing?
Negative. No. Too deep to that. Nope.
Okay, very good. 73, John. 73, Dick.
And the air that inflates that bladder to bring you back up, if any leak occurs in that tank so that compressed air is no longer available to you, I don't think there's a backup for that one, is there, John?
Yes, Dick. They would drop the weights. As long as you had watertight integrity of the vessel, even if the tanks didn't evacuate completely, you dropped the weights, the thing would surface.
You called it a very large glass dome. That large dome, was that possibly plexiglass? Go ahead.
Yes, it was a polycarbonate of some type. It looked like, if you imagine what the bombers view in a B-29 with the bubble in the front, that's the way the craft looked. When you were inside, you were looking out of this large lens.
Was this part of your occupation, or was this something that you did for recreation? In which case, what was the price of you, the passenger, on that dive?
It was while I was on vacation in the Caymans, and the Caymans, and my wife and I and the pilot went down, and it was about... $800 for the dive, something like that.
So the pilot, you and your wife, three people were on board, is that what you're saying, John? Go ahead.
Yeah, that was the maximum it could take.
Sounds brave to me. Bye-bye, you all. We'll see you guys next week. Back to you for any other cover.
Dick, 73s, Paul, Dick, everyone on the net. Thank you for joining the net, and interesting, and we'll pick it up again next week. All's well, we'll be back. And be kind to each other. KC2WGB.
Report number 1996 with a release date of Friday, January 29, 2016. The follow in 5. Four.
Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Inside the American Legion Hall in Palm Springs. Almost 70 years later, that booth has been restored glory and is now the new home of the Post Amateur Radio Club. Amateur Radio Newsline's Kent Peterson, KCY, tells us what the club has planned next.
Palm Springs American Legion Post 519 isn't quite the typical Legion Hall.
Inside is a big L-shaped bar, a big seating area with tables for the kitchen. And at the far end is this very large stage that's the whole width of the dining area.
That's K6TAL Ham Club President Glenn Morrison, WB6 RLC.
We've been doing a lot of research and been finding news clippings. Kind of call it the Jack Benny Room because that's the most. Bob Hope and Al Jolson and Frank Sinatra, all those people all performed off of that stage. At one side of the stage is a sound booth. It had just been a storeroom for the last 40 or 50 years. Oh, man, wouldn't that make a great ham radio shack? So we approached the commander of the post, told him what we wanted to do. Go ahead. Can't cost us any money, so we started tearing into it and out and cleaning it up. Inside we found a RCA Model 77C microphone, and RCA, I think it's OP6 and OP7, it's a microphone and then a mixer driver that drives the, I think it was set the phone line that would send the signal back to Los Angeles. Probably for Jack Benny.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Note number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Note number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Note number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Note number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.